Blog Talk Radio.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, just bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your ship bare.
Introduce your co-hosts, Nell Cole and David Little Eagle. Man, I really like that song. Love that song, Adelaide, Rolling in the Deep. And I really like that line, we could have had it all. Well, by the end of this show, we're going to give you 13 rules of dealing with the sociopaths that we deal with in our everyday lives. Now, if you use them, that all depends on you. You can find these posted to the Facebook group, Fire Talk Productions, /StageLeft, and posted on the front of the advertisement. To start the show off with, though, I'd like to start with the rule of three, since it is again mentioned in the 13 rules that we're going to go over and discuss. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to today's panel. Today we have with us Kenneth Dole. Kenneth is the author of the book, Mother from Hell, which tells the story being raised by a brutal sociopath and was failed by the institutions that were designed to protect him. Kevin is on Facebook, and I would recommend you getting a copy of his book at www.mother-from-hell.com. Once again, that's mother-from-hell.com. Also joining us today is Elaine Parker. Elaine is a trained counselor and also was on our first guest last week when we talked about conflict resolution. So with that being said, welcome, David. Now.
Thank you, Russ. Working to get Elaine on. She was experiencing some echoing, so hopefully she's going to call right back in.
Yeah, I heard that echoing. I was kind of like standing off of it and trying to go through the script there. But, we do have Kenneth on the line with us. Welcome, Kenneth.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. Ken Doyle here. As you said, I am the author of Mother from Hell. I'm the victim of some terrible child abuse that went on in Ireland for 16 years of my life, along with my brother Patrick. Our mother was a total sociopath. I didn't know what a sociopath was till maybe the year of 2007, until my own counselor told me I was to go out and buy a book called The Sociopath Next Door. I purchased a book, and it gave me a lot of answers to a lot of questions I had. I mean, for years and years and years, I've always thought that my mother would one day reach out and try and get back to me and say, I'm sorry for what I've done. It's always been on my mind, and I always wanted to get back with my family and stuff over the years. But as the psychologist told me, he said, well, he said, your problem is your mother is a sociopath. He said, so you got to go out and read this book, and which I did. And I could never believe that there is people born without a conscience. But when we were being tortured and stuff as children by our mother, she never once said she was sorry for anything she'd done. So the book kind of helped me understand why she didn't say sorry, because she had no conscience in what she was doing to us. And as far as I'm concerned, she got a kick out of what she was doing.
Let me ask you a question, Kevin. I'm sorry, Kenneth. In your in reading this book and in your understanding and going through your therapy and the life that you have lived, is not having a conscience the same thing as not having emotions?
Yes. Yes. That's why I said there that the mother never apologized. Like, the beatings were on a daily basis, and she would never say, you know, we'd be black and blue on the ground, unable to walk, unable to move, and she'd never even say she's sorry. So a person that can't say they're sorry, they have no emotion for what she just done. For some reason, she would bless herself before she would start the beatings and then bless herself when she was finished. I have no idea what that was all about, this blessing, but she never once said she was sorry. And even at my age now, at 47, I always think to myself, Jesus, wouldn't it be nice if she would just say, you know, I'm sorry for what I'd done, I was sick or whatever. But after I read The Sociopath Next Door, it kind of told me I'm never going to receive that apology, because the woman had no conscience in the first place, so she doesn't feel that she done anything wrong to me. And that's what a typical sociopath is. They just don't care what they have done, and they will deny everything. I contacted my mother back in about 2002, and I tried to talk to her on the telephone, and she was cold as ice with me. She said she never abused me. She just denied everything. And I still didn't understand until the psychologist, you know, at Penn told me, get out there and get that sociopath next door. He said, read that. He said, and it'll give you a description of what your mother is like. But I could not believe that there is such people out there without conscience. And I guess there's 1 in 25 Americans. And we have to be careful who they are, because they can be in high places.
Yeah. It's just... It's almost like the boogeyman hiding behind the corner. You never know when you're going to run into it, but the odds are in your life, in your everyday communications, you are going to have to deal with the sociopath.
Correct, yes.
You know, so the rule of three. I'm going to read this little thing. It's about a paragraph long. I'm going to rule it, and then we'll open up the panel, and we'll start discussing. When considering a new relationship of any kind, you should practice the rule of three regarding the claims and promises a person makes and the responsibility he or she has. Now, this is a rule of three, I believe, that will then give you your first signs or tales, I guess, of what a person is. To me, I call it my intuition. It's I can read a person right off the bat, whether they're good or bad. But this goes on to say, make the rule of three your personal policy. One lie, one broken promise, or a single neglected responsibility may be a misunderstanding. Absolutely. Instead, two may involve a serious mistake. Understandable. You make the same mistake twice and it's severe. Yeah, we got a mistake going on here. The three lines says we're dealing with a liar. And deceit is the linchpin of conscience behavior. Cut your losses and get out as soon as you can. Leaving, though it may be hard, may be easier now than later and less costly. Do not give money, your work, your secrets, or your affection to a three-timer. Your valuable gifts will be wasted. But that said, let's open up the panel to speak. I'm with it. You know, you lie to me once, yeah, that could be a misunderstanding. You lie to me twice, that definitely is a serious mistake and a flaw in your character. But when you lie to me three times, you are now a liar. And I have no more room in my life for lies. What do you guys have to say to that?
Well, I would definitely say I wouldn't give them a third chance. I think the second time, after going through the experience I went through, I think the second time I would warn off immediately, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even give them a third. I wouldn't give them a third chance.
Well, coming from your experience, I agree with you 100%. You probably wouldn't even get the chance to lie to me to begin with, because I wouldn't be too outwardly looking to bring in new relationships into this life, you know. So I understand where you're coming from, absolutely.
Yeah. I suffer from PTSD, so I am cautious at all times. And after dealing with the mother and just what went down within our household, I saw a lot of lying, cheating, stealing, and I've seen it going on in my family, other family members doing the same thing. So I have very little trust in people. It takes me a long time to get to know a person anymore. I'd say the second time a person lies to me, that's it. I don't want to know them.
Yeah. How about promises? Were you promised a lot as a child?
No.
Okay.
One promise that was made to me as a child was one day my mother broke my right leg and she knew she had done wrong. She could clearly see the leg was broken and stuff. And while she was waiting for the ambulance, she started crying. And her words to me were, "Oh, please, please don't tell them that I done it. Tell them you fell down the stairs. They're going to lock me up. They're going to put me in jail." And then she started making this promise to me. She said, "I promise you this will never happen again. This will never happen again. When you get out of hospital, I'm going to love you," and all this kind of stuff. And I felt sorry for her because it was the first time I'd ever seen her like begging for mercy. And, of course, I thought, oh, maybe this is the end of it. Maybe she won't do any of this anymore. And within 6 or 7 weeks out of the hospital, I was there for 3 months. About 6 or 7 weeks out of the hospital, she was back to her old game again. It was totally broken. Her little promise was broken. So, you know, it's hard for me to trust people when they make promises to me.
Well, she was very good at it, because I'm going to tell you what I just heard you tell me. That when she could have been charged or looked into or pointed the finger at that she broke your leg, which could have helped you in the institutions that eventually failed you, she turned herself into the victim there.
Yes.
She then broke down and started crying and worked on your emotions, knowing that you had them. She turned herself
right
into the victim, and you wanted to believe her, because all you ever wanted to do was for her to love you as her, as your mother.
That's correct.
So she was
No matter what she done to me, I always wanted my mother's love. And it wasn't there.
Childhood.
It just was not there. She was just too shallow. I noticed with the rest of the kids, yeah, she'd give them a hug. I can never say I got a hug from my own mother. She would hug the rest of the kids. She would make us jealous, myself and Patrick, that we weren't loved. She'd call us. She'd say, "You're ugly bastards, and I love this one, and I love this one, but you two are ugly, and I hope you get killed by a car." And it's like we didn't exist, but we still wanted her as a mother. I mean, I knew there was something wrong with her back then. I mean, there had to be something wrong. There was just no way. Other children weren't going through what we were going through. And I knew there had to be something wrong with her. But the authorities were well aware of what she was up to. You know, the medical files that I have show that this woman, her own husband, went into the authorities and said, "This woman is starving my children. The children are only getting one meal a day when I'm not in the house." But everybody allowed her to do it, so that's why she was able to continue to do it. She was able to, when we went up to the childcare services, she warned us before we went in there, "If you say anything, I'll kill you when I get you back home." And we were petrified all the time from her, 24 hours a day. This woman was a very scary woman to live with. She'd be in a good mood 1 minute, and then send all the kids out while she could batter the two of us in the house and have no remorse for what she'd done.
And that kind of person can be in any part of a relationship. It could be the mother, it could be the father, it could be the husband, it could be the wife, it could be the boyfriend, the girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, well, since I wrote the book, I've been getting hundreds of emails from all around the world. And some of the stuff I'm hearing now, I just had a lady this morning contact me. I believe she's in South Africa. And she said, "I want to confront my mother with what she has done to me. How am I going to go about doing it?" Well, for a start, I mean, how do you confront a sociopath? Because no matter what you say to them, they're not the guilty person. They do not feel that they've done anything wrong. And that's what my psychologist told me. A sociopath will deny everything. You were the person that caused it all. They'll blame everything on you. And I was advised never to go back to the situation. And, you know, it's hard for me to tell other people, you know, "Hey, go and talk to her." You can't go and talk to them, because there's no point in really talking to a sociopath, because they're not going to take the blame for the stuff that they do.
Right.
When the police were investigating the crimes against myself and my brother Patrick, they said they brought my mother into the police station, and the detective told me, he said, "There's something up with your mother." He said, "I had your mother in here, and I read your statement out to her." He said, "And you know what? It went right through one ear and out through the other ear." He said, "Nothing sunk in at all." He said, "I talked to her about breaking your leg, and she just turned around and said, 'Yeah, wasn't that terrible?'" So again, she'd no conscience even when she was confronted by the police. You know, and she still thinks she was right for what she'd done.
Wow. Anyone else on the panel got anything to ask or add?
Russ, Elaine is still having trouble getting in, so I'm going to give her a quick call and then three-way her in. So y'all go ahead, and I'll be right back.
Go ahead and do
right
that behind the
it.
Scenes. Thank
yeah.
you. David. Are you with us, David?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
You know what? I am shocked because as I hear this story, I can relate to a great degree that if not for my ability to express myself, sometimes I'd just be stunned into silence. But I dealt with a sociopath in my own childhood. Now the difference in my story is that at one point I did confront the sociopath. I did confront my father. And I made him cry. Unfortunately, because of the PTSD situation, the PTSD state, what happened was that I learned anger. And I saw abuse on a daily basis, and like my brother, we experienced terror every day. My mother, my brothers, one of my brothers in particular suffered more than the rest of us. I was the one with the chutzpah. I was the one with the courage, I guess, to actually confront him and challenge him. When he challenged me to a fight the last time, he said, "You want to take it out and settle it?" I said, "Let's go. And let's finish it permanently." He backed down and never, ever challenged me again.
Yeah.
So I'm practically in tears because I'm hearing this story, and there are so many who are left in a state of helplessness. And it is true, you cannot confront a sociopath. Because there is no response from them. There are no emotions. There is no acknowledgement of any wrongs. It's like I was reading yesterday, forgiveness is not for those who don't see the wrongs in what they do.
Absolutely.
So I cannot forgive you. So I just want to sit back and listen to the rest of this and learn. And I want to thank Mr. Nina.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I too, now that I'm in this discussion and now that I have read through these 13 rules that we're going to get to here in a minute, you start to see these people in your life. My mother was married to a man, my stepfather, who was a police officer in the town that we lived in, and he was brutal. He was brutal. He would beat her, and we were too young to do anything. Me and my younger brother was just too young to do anything, and we lived in the household. And it wasn't until my older brother came home, and one of these incidents took place, and my older brother beat the hell out of him. And as we grew older, me and my younger brother realized, you beat the hell out of that person when you see him do that to our mother. But at the time, we're not thinking that, sociopath. We're thinking this man is just a psychopath. He's a crazy nut. But, you know, children today grow up in this society where this is still acceptable. It still happens today, and it affects the children's psyche to who they become as an adult. It absolutely does. Some of us make it through. I feel that I'm a very strong person. I've got my things together. I do what I have to do, and I don't expect nobody to do it for me. It's all done by me because this is my life. This is my freedom. Of controlling who I am, and that's who
does,
I am.
It definitely does make you stronger, mm-hmm. especially if you were a victim of these crimes. And it does make you aware of your surroundings. That man that was just saying there, he was beaten and he went through daily torture. And it was the same in our house. I mean, it was from the time we woken up. We'd be woken up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and dragged out of bed. Freezing cold and made to clean out the fireplace and do all the slave work of the house before the other children got up and stuff. I don't know why my mother picked out two of us out of the nine children. Yeah, I don't understand that part. I don't understand, and I didn't write see anything in the sociopath next door. I still can't figure out how she picked two from nine and didn't go after the rest of them. Now, mentally, she mentally tortured the rest of the children in the house. She called them all sorts of names. They weren't never called by their proper names. They were always told that they were going to be nothing when they get older and everything. But I just could never figure out why she went after just the two of us. And I did try to confront my mother. I did talk to her on the telephone, and I called her back in the year 2000, and I said to her, listen here, I said, I want to ask you a few questions, I said, about what went on years ago. And her, basically, it was like she'd been waiting to call for that call for years. She just turned around and she said, fire away. And I said to her, I said, why did you starve us as children? She said, you didn't like food. I said, why did you beat us every day of the week for all our life? And she said, you were bad children. I said, why did you break our bones? Oh, she said, that was self-defense. So she had answers for everything. And like that man just said there a minute ago, you can't confront them. I was actually, once I got this, read the book, The Sociopath Next Door, it was like after getting an apology from my mother, because the book kind of told me, you're not going to get an apology from her. You're not going to get any closure from this woman. And she remains to be as cruel today as she was back 60s and 70s. She's still a cruel, evil person. So, and there is no medicine. My psychologist said there is really nothing you can do for a sociopath, only lock them up away from people, because if they're, like I was the victim, my psychologist said, Ken, there was victims after you left that house. Somebody else had to become the victim. So, you know, the reign of terror goes on, and you're better off not even trying to get an apology from your abuser, because, as I said, I waited for years thinking it was going to happen, where she would say she was sorry for what she'd done, but you know, that all that thought's gone out of my head now, because I know she had no conscience in what she was doing, and you know, authorities knew, and they should have stepped in and said, this woman needs to be put away where she can't hurt other people.
Yep.
But they never did do that.
All right.
Hey, Kenneth, I have a theory that the reason why they pick certain kids out and not all others is to kind of mask their behavior. Like, look what a good parent I am, except for these children who are just so bad that I have no choice but to do this to them. So it's their way of hiding the evil that they are by separating the children and saying, I'm a good mother to these. Look how wonderful a mother I am here. It's these evil bastards here. If they would just behave, I would be a wonderful mother to all my children.
Nell, I remember when we were little boys, and the mother would take us out on the town, and somebody might just turn around and say it, because she was starving me so much. When I was 9 years old, I looked like a 5-year old, and I was very skinny and frail and everything because of the starvation. And people would say, "Oh, look there, a poor Kenneth. He's beautiful." And she would just out of the blue turn around and say, "Oh no, he's not. He's the devil of the house."
Right.
And the rest of them, she would say, oh, no, Kieran's a good boy, or Ivor's a good boy, Michelle's a good girl, and all this stuff. But when it came to me and Patrick, she would say, oh, no, they're the devil.
Right, because she had to sell the fact that, to explain why she was beating her children, she had to sell it to the society that, look how bad these children are, to where the rest of the neighborhood would be like, those are bad children.
And they're clever, because she actually premeditated her crimes against us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I told that to my psychologist. When I told my psychologist, I said, David, listen here. I said, this woman would write notes. If we kicked over another kid's toy, she would write that in a piece of paper and stick it in her pocket, and that would be the next beating. She always had a reason to beat us. So she would find something to cover her tracks should anything happen. But the day she broke my leg, she sat there and she was crying her eyes out, and she said, "No, please, please, Ken, tell them you fell down the stairs. They'll lock me up. You'll never see me again," and all this crap. And she came up to the hospital. She would be visiting every day, bringing up toys and everything else, until she got me out and back home again. And she started her little regime again against me as soon as I got home.
What's amazing about these... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
I'm sorry. No. I was just curious. Do you know anything about your mother's own upbringing, what your grandparents were like?
Well, the police in Ireland, done an investigation, and they investigated her, and they said that they could not find any abuse that was in her side of the family. And that's what I could never figure out. But a sociopath doesn't show any sickness or anything. I mean, she was on Valium before we were even born. And I remember my grandfather, when I was in hospital, he used to sneak into the hospital at night time because he never wanted to be there in front of the mother. And he used to say to me, "I told your father never to go near her. He should never have went near her." And the doctors are saying that she was on Valium before any of the kids were even born. So she had medical problems. But again, it was Catholic Ireland, so
yeah.
You know, they wanted you to breed as many children as you could.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Elaine, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Hi. We had a little difficulty getting you here, but welcome.
Thank you. I haven't heard everything you've been saying, Kenneth. Is it Kenneth?
Yes.
It is, Elaine. How are you doing?
So, hi, it's good to meet you, and I'm very moved by your story. As you may or may not know my background, I'm an Adlerian psychotherapist based on the ideas of Alfred Adler, and he has quite a different take on some of these personality disorders. And Adlerians believe that the linchpin of life is social interest, that sense of belonging, and how we communicate with others. And what happens in these antisocial personality disorders like psychosis and psychopaths and kind of neurosis is that for various reasons people are less able to connect with others on a kind of equal basis. And so whatever, there may be causes in childhood, they may have been responding to something, or they may just be needing to create their own world. So what they do is they actually create their own life, their own inner life and their own world, which disassociates them from others because they can't fulfill that task of connecting. So they create their own world so that they have their own logic. So she obviously had, your mother obviously had her own logic about, well, she could obviously mistreat you two and the others were okay. There may have been something in you two that reminded her of something in herself or something in her childhood. We don't know that. But the real difficulty is in us trying to communicate with those people because they don't have what Adler calls common sense, which is that understanding that is common to all of us of how life goes. They only live in their own private world. So I heard you saying earlier about, you know, you giving her a call and wondering if somehow she might be able to give you some explanation or some kind of apology or you trying to understand. But she probably can't understand and can't explain it and maybe doesn't even want to connect. Because the other thing is that person-to-person, soul-to-soul connection for people who have got antisocial personality disorders, it's actually not possible. It's not even a bit painful, but it's actually not possible. There's something there that they don't know how to do it. They don't know what's next.
Now, Elaine, one thing that I did notice all my life was she had no friends. She never built a relationship with a neighbor.
No.
Nothing.
No. Yeah, yeah. So that, in a way, agrees with what I was just saying about that inability to connect, to have social interest, that inability to belong. And
yeah.
We don't know what went on in her life and what her kind of private logic is, if you like, as opposed to her common sense. But, you know, there must be something that is way, way too difficult for her to manage in real life, in reality. So she has to create her own world where...
Right.
Let me read you just a little tiny paragraph here. I've got this wonderful book called Psychopathology and Psychotherapy, which is an Adlerian book. But this is Adler's own words. He says, unlike the neurotic, the psychopath has no inner conflict. He has failed to develop sufficient common sense. He denies the logic of others, never accepts their values and morals, and considers his own interests as the only motivation that counts. Therefore, he needs no alibis and flaunts his own interests and tendencies. So there's nothing there. There is no commonality. They've created their own logic. It's only their values that count. Other people's logic doesn't make sense. So it's a very difficult... So I think what I'm saying is that, and I don't know if someone else said this earlier, is that somehow connection is almost impossible for you towards her because she can't receive it.
Right.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, she has told me from day one that she never wanted me.
Yeah, yeah.
And... Yeah. Before I was born, you'll see in our book where she was beating her stomach with me in her womb, calling me little bastard, the whole thing. So she kind of singled us out for this treatment. One of the things that myself and Patrick think, myself and Patrick look very close to our father.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe my father was afraid of her, and that's why he took off to America and stayed in America and only came home once a year. And I think our resemblance to him, you have to remember there was no, you couldn't get divorced in Ireland only up to a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Okay,
so, I mean, you made your nest, you were screwed. So, and we often wonder, was it because we looked like our father so close?
You might well have reminded her of him.
That's what I'm thinking too.
That may well have provoked something in her.
So you were all from different fathers?
Pardon?
You were from different fathers, you and your brothers and sisters?
No. There's five boys and four girls.
All from the same father?
All from the same father. And he worked in America. He worked up in Connecticut. And he would come home once a year, maybe around Christmas time. And by the time he'd be ready to come back to America, she'd be pregnant again. But he knew about the abuse himself, and he was very scared of her. And he, according to my medical records, it's showing that he was reporting her for abusing us before he left to come back to the States. I think he was hoping that somebody else would go and do the job and rescue us. But he was actually running off to America, and I don't think he was just following work. Because everybody else, you know, had their father at home with them in Ireland. And I think he was running away from her at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, you kids couldn't do.
No.
Yeah.
No. And we really wish he could have took us out and he should have taken us away from her.
Mm.
We're gonna direct the show heading into the 13 rules dealing with the sociopath in everyday life. That way we can get these 13 rules in, and we can stop and discuss on each one, which we basically, between Elaine just speaking and Kenneth, what you've been telling us, we've actually already spoke on them, but we can get into them more as we get into them one by one, so to say. So number one of the 13 rules of dealing with the sociopath in your everyday life is to accept that some people literally have no conscience and that these people look just like us. Which we're basically saying, it's your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your boss, you know?
Yeah. I think that's really important to realize that, because what I was just saying is that you are not going to be able to communicate with them on an equal and human level. Their logic, their understanding is very different to us. They may look like us, but they don't think like us and they don't feel like us.
And they're very good at wearing a mask. So you have to watch their behavior and believe yourself, even when everybody around is going, no, he's a wonderful person.
Yeah.
I don't know what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
You have to just trust yourself.
Yeah.
So when you finally feel you have a compromise with somebody, that they heard you, you're on the same page, and that's when those lies and broken promises start coming in. I mean, you may be dealing with the psychopath if. Go. You know?
Exactly.
Number two is listen to your instincts. Absolutely. Your voice is your connection to who you are. Always listen to it. Listen to your instincts, alarms, and red flags, no matter what role the person is in. Meaning, if this person is superior to you, like your boss or
your priest.
Absolutely. And those instincts. Nell and I had a little post about this gut feeling, this churning that we call it over here, your churning stomach. And very often it is in the stomach, in the solar plexus area. We feel discomfort. We feel a bit queasy. We feel our heart pounding. Our stomach's going round and round like a washing machine when that person is anywhere near us. But they might be charming and there might be a lovely kind of feeling, but your stomach is churning for a reason. Yeah. So you know, I work a lot with this when I'm training students and working with clients. That's that gut. It's the gut instinct. It's what we call the gut instinct. It's trying to tell you something.
Right.
It's giving you a warning. It's saying there's something odd here. There's something not right. What I see isn't the same as what I feel.
And you brought up a very good point there.
Yeah.
You brought up a very good point that they come charming. These people, like Kenneth just explained, are conniving. They plan this stuff out prior to doing it. So they do come with charm until they get you wheeled in. You, unfortunately, was born into something, and it's a tragedy. It's just a tragedy.
Well, the thing is they build their excuses. So they build things that make you question less, like becoming priests or leaders or the head of child abuse organizations, all these different things.
Yeah.
To prevent you from going like, no way, look at all the great stuff he's done. And those things hide more and more the reality of who they are.
Oh, I've heard
superiority.
I've heard stories of people writing to me telling me that their parent, maybe the father, was the mayor of the town, and he was a pure sociopath to his family. But the whole town liked him.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
Very
often these people are pillars of the church, pillars of the community, and the minute the door is closed on their family life, you're walking into hell.
Excuse me, may I bring up a point? I'm going to play devil's advocate because I'm very good at that. Well, first, let me mention the fact that my own father was a church elder, choir director, very well respected in the community, very well respected in the church, until a certain incident exposed him for a completely unrelated incident. But as far as sociopaths looking like everybody else, I want to point out something that Kenneth had brought up before. How much like anybody else do they look? when a mother's love is so highly praised, which I think is a crock of shit, because I think there are mothers out there that are, that should never have had children. But
correct.
When Kenneth and Patrick were with her and walking in public, and somebody says, "Oh, what beautiful children," Mama Dearest says, "Oh, those two? No, they're evil. They're the devils themselves. They're the worst ones in the house." Doesn't that itself set themselves apart from not necessarily looking like anybody else? And also, because the sociopath has an isolationist behavioral pattern, hence sociopath, they have a social pathology. Doesn't that mark a distinction between them and somebody else who perhaps is a little more gregarious? Is it possible? Because, you know, sociopaths can be leaders. I mean, we have a whole bunch of sociopaths in Senate and Congress, heavens
yeah.
no, and I'm not going to mention names, but Hillary Clinton they can be leaders and seem very intelligent. Now, the one thing I do notice about a leader is that when they present themselves in public, except with, you know, with notable exceptions like Bill Clinton, who was rather gregarious. I like the way he spoke. The same with Jimmy Carter. They were very pleasant. They had a southern persona. Then you had presidents like Richard M. Nixon, who was such a he had such a poor social image, but these attention seekers. But there I think that there are varying levels of sociopathology, where you have the ones that don't have friends. Am I correct in what you said, Kenneth? That your mother had no friends.
She had no friends.
So there are sociopaths who want absolutely nothing to do with the public. So I think that it's not a rule of thumb that they would be like everybody. Something different about them that makes people shun them or they shun others.
See, but I think there's also something more there, though. There's what I call the light switch effect. They can turn it on and they can turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the light switch effect in there. When she has to go out in public and be social, like to the grocery store, whatever went on in her daily life, like paying a bill or whatever she had to do within the town itself, when she had to be out in public, she turned her switch on.
Mm-hmm.
When my mother came out in public, she was dressed like the Queen of England. She had better clothes than everybody else had. And she just walked down the town like, actually, we call her Mrs. Bucket. She was like Mrs. Bucket. She had to have everything better than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pearls hanging out of her and everything else. But once she came in the door, she turned back into this demon. Yeah, she was like a light switch.
I think also, if I can just come in for a second, is that there are, what's the word, that there's like a spectrum to this as well. So there are some people who would be right at the extreme end of that spectrum, like the one I described earlier, the psychopath, where they deny the logic of others, they live in their own world, they create their own reality, they don't need alibis, it's only their own interests that are valid in their world. So that's the very extreme end. But there's also lower sort of activity, if you like. You know, there's people who are neurotic, where they don't admit their tendencies when they're in conflict with their conscience. They look for alibis, they look for excuses. So that's the softer end of it, if you like, where they've got
right.
a little bit of connection with others. And then
right.
in the middle, there's the psychosis, where they deal with their inner conflicts by changing temporarily, I'm quoting here, or indefinitely, their recognition of the common sense, of the common understanding. So they might have delusions, hallucinations. They can impress themselves with their assumed reality, which conforms with their private logic. So the world is, they live in a world of their own, and their personal goals are justified, and their logic isn't shared by others. But they go in and out of it. So sometimes they seem to be connecting, and then at other times their delusions come in. So there is kind of a spectrum to this.
Yeah,
so that might explain why sometimes she looked great. She looked like, you know, Mrs. Bucket and well-dressed and smiled at other people. And then other times, no.
Yeah.
Well, image is everything when you have no soul.
Guys, we have 40 minutes left for our number three. We need to keep them moving.
Okay.
Number three, I mean, we can get lost. We can do it 13 segments if you guys would like. Well, number three is 13. We have 40 minutes. Number three, I'm just going to skim over because we already went over it. It's common sense. It's the rule of three. If you are lied to, or if promises are broken once, that is a misunderstanding, absolutely. That's when you communicate. Number two, I'm sorry, not number two. If it happens a second time, there's a serious mistake going on here, whether it is in the communication between you two or you may be dealing with a psychopath. Now, if it happens three times, cut your losses. You're dealing with a liar. You're dealing with someone who can never give you what you need, and you should never deal or accept less than what you deserve. So you need to know these things to start looking for them. Number four. We're going to, number four of dealing with the psychopath in your everyday life is questioning authority. Do this even when, or especially when, everyone around you has completely stopped questioning authority. Recite yourself what Stanley Milgram taught us about obedience, which I don't know what that is. Maybe you can enlighten us, Sarah Lane.
Keep reading. It's right there.
Okay.
It's in the bracket.
At least six out of ten people will blindly obey a present official-looking authority to the bitter end. Absolutely true. I tell people all the time, walk in and do it like you're supposed to be there and no one will question you. Am I a psychopath for giving that kind of advice?
Mm-hmm.
I tell people all the time? You know? Use my name if you have to. Just walk in, act like you know what you're doing. No one will question you. So that is true.
And that's where genocide hides in that number four all the time.
Because
as soon as they put on a pair of pants and a shirt and a collar or whatever uniform, then people go blind to the person that's actually wearing that.
Good point connection there, now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead to the next one.
Number five, suspect flattery. We all have this one. We all have the ass kisser that's in our life. That flatters you no matter what. It is the material of counterfeit charm. And it always involves an intent to manipulate. Absolutely. They manipulate you to compliment you. You seem to be, I want to be around that person. They compliment me all the time. The more you put yourself in their path, the more that they can manipulate you. Manipulation through flattery is something innocuous. And sometimes it's sinister.
Right.
Peek over your, what does it say? Peek over your massaged ego and remember to suspect flattery. Now, I'm not telling you to become cynical at all. You accept flattery humbly and graciously, but someone who flatters you and humbles you all the time, especially in around other people, you should probably be looking at it like that. That's kind of strange.
I was just going to say with this flattery, actually, your stomach can do its washing machine thing just as much with this as it does with lies.
Exactly.
Because the flattery is lies.
Yeah.
So, again, we can get that gut instinct. We can get that churning, that washing machine spinning and think, oh, why are they being so nice to me? This is a bit extreme, you know. Okay, you know, say I've done a good job or whatever, but to constantly keep saying how wonderful I am, what are they looking for?
And they're very good at knowing those people who are starving for attention and pulling them in.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and then it goes on to say, which makes another good point here, this flattery rule applies on an individual basis. An argument can easily be made that humanity will have peace when nations of people are at last able to see through this masterful flattery, which you were bringing up in number four, which is the genocide now. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That we face today.
Because we will believe in all the hype, and even though there's no substance.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We are a society of people that fall for the hype and propaganda. Absolutely we are.
Yes, we did and do.
And I think some of that comes from our own beliefs that we want to be good citizens. You know, we want to belong. We want to do the right thing. And so we've got to be really careful in how we interpret what authority tells us.
Exactly.
Right.
Because some of us think, the right thing to do is to be a good citizen. But if that conflicts with your sense of what is right and wrong, there's a conflict there. So how do you deal with that conflict? What responsibility can you take? What can you do?
Very good point. Very good point. Number six. I'm sorry, David. Go.
No, I just wanted to quickly interject something. What I've seen in many of the sociopathic behaviors, and I just want to say this quickly, is how in public, well, I don't know, with the exception of Kenneth, who was blasted, you know, in public, which is disgusting behavior, but, you know, oh, you're so wonderful, you're so beautiful, you're so intelligent, you're so talented, you're so this and that, and then at home, it cuts them to pieces, and that's part of the sociopath pattern.
It's a way, really, sociopaths want to find a way of being significant and, in fact, being powerful and superior. How do they make themselves matter? And they do that by ruling other people.
Right.
And having their own world. And other people are essentially like tools. You know, other people are just objects to be used.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of that in my house.
Yeah.
Number six is redefining your concept of respect. Fear is not respect. Great statement. You know, and that's exactly what it is. Don't feed the fear. You know,
and it's hard when we live in a fear-based society.
In Kenneth's, right, and then in Kenneth's situation as a child, you know, I mean, this is good advice for an adult who, as the article is meant for, to point out these signs of the psychopath in your everyday life. But as a child, that's kind of hard to do, you know?
It's petrifying. When the sociopath has total control over you, I mean, a lot of people have asked me, why didn't I run away? Why didn't I fight her back or something? When you have a person, I mean, when my mother went off in the house, she may pick up a knife from the knife block and chase you with a knife, and you thought you were going to die. I mean, I lived my life in total fear every day. I did not want to waken up. I didn't want to see... Just every day, it was constant. So a sociopath can make a child's life total fear.
Yeah, where's that child going to run to? That child already knows that nothing and nobody has stopped what it is facing or what the life it's living. So that the only thing that I could think of that child would think is, no matter where I run, she'll catch me, and it'll even be worse.
Well, and when he did run, the police just took him back and even called and slapped him in the head.
Where's the child to run to?
Yeah,
right.
Well, there was nowhere to run.
Yeah.
As an Irish Catholic, both myself and Patrick, when she'd lock us up into the back bedroom, we would kneel down and we would pray to God. And I remember this when I was 7 and 8 years of age, and I'd say, please, God, please take us today, either take suffer any longer. And that's when they can control a child like that. I mean, we were living in total fear. When we ran away, the police would pick us up and bring us right back to her. Now, even though the authorities knew about it and the authorities were feeding her with Valium, they knew there was a problem going on in that house. Her husband had told them. And I feel that they were just a sociopathic, their behavior was just as bad because they actually knew she was a nut and didn't do nothing to stop it. I mean, how can you sit and write medical files about a child who is wasting away and is nothing but skin and bones without doing something.
Well, when you're raised by nuns that beat you in society as the norm, then things like that just get desensitized.
And I also think the same thing's going on there in Ireland with all that child abuse that went on in the Catholic schools. Those children were living with sociopaths among them. Not all the Christian Brothers were bad, but the ones who tortured children and stuff, they got into those positions where they were in power and could show their power over a child. And that's what they'd done to the children. So there was a lot of sociopaths within the church.
But let's make it very clear. Let's make it very, very clear on this show today and with that statement made. A lot of them did do these things to children, and some of them did not. That does not excuse the some who did not. They were just as liable.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to make that clear.
Those who knew.
Yeah.
Those who knew from the bishops on down.
Mm-hmm.
To me, were sociopaths, because if somebody came to me and said, my little Timmy here was abused by Father so-and-so, I would pick up the phone and call the police immediately. I wouldn't call the bishop and ask him what to do. I would call the police because it's a crime against a child. And the Catholic Church don't see it as crimes. They tell you that these Christian brothers and nuns that molested children were just sick people.
They don't live under the same laws of society. They don't live under the same laws of society. They're ruled by canon law. So they're not obligated
they want, to Well, they want to live
law.
By canon law. They want to live by canon law. They shouldn't be allowed to operate unless they live by the law of the land where child molestation is a crime.
Ahoy. Absolutely.
Nothing to do with the bishop. The local priest should pick up the telephone and call the police.
I was going to say something. I don't know if you want to continue with your sequence or not. So tell me if you do, and I'll stop now.
No, you can say your thing, and then we'll move on to number seven.
Okay. And it's just really because what I'm hearing is a huge amount of anguish and anger and discouragement and helplessness for yourself as that child. You know, that sense that there is nothing, and actually it's so bad you want to die. You want God to take you now. But what I am hearing underneath that is your courage to survive.
Yeah.
You didn't die. You didn't damage yourself. You stayed. You hung on somehow. So your creativity as that young boy to survive, to find a way, to fight in the way you're fighting now shows immense courage and creativity and the stuff of real kind of grit and survivability. And so, you know, that I think is really an important thing here, not to allow ourselves to feel that we are helpless, because you have courage and you did act and you are acting now.
Yeah.
You know?
Kenneth is always
protecting
other survivors. He's such a strong man.
Yeah. Yeah,
your past becomes who you are today.
Yeah.
When you know the truth of your past, it is the person you become today, and it becomes your wisdom. That's why it's very, very important that history is told correctly. It will stop the mistakes from happening again.
Yeah.
But this country does not apply that.
Yeah.
It allows the lie of history to allow the mistakes to continue, because it is through their colonization that they strive in their capitalism.
Yeah, and that's where what you're doing is so important. And there's also that the understanding from a psychological and therapeutic point of view that actually you can't change the past, and these things did happen. But what you have got control over is how you deal with it now. It's what you do with it.
Sure.
So you're turning it into something really powerful and really positive.
Yes, he is.
You know, you're not sitting there thinking, well, I am now helpless. You're not helpless.
I don't think he's turning into it. He's been it for a while.
Kevin's
been a long way. This that isn't what he's becoming. He's already there. He's produced
the
book.
He's
gone through therapy.
That strength.
Just that little boy that we all want to grab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
number seven will be.
Should you read seven and eight together just to make a little progress?
Let's go on. Number seven, do not join the game. Intrigue is the sociopath's tool. It's what they use to trap you, intrigue. Resist the temptation to compete with the very seductive sociopath to outsmart him, to psychoanalyze or even banter with him. You know, it goes back to that saying, never argue with an idiot. In addition to reducing yourself to this level, you should be distracting yourself from what is really important. You would be distracting yourself from what is really important, which is to protect yourself. So what it's telling you is if you go into combat with an idiot, you're going to get distracted from what you and your path is. And you're going to get stuck there. And that's through that intrigue, they can use that to manipulate you. Number eight, the best way to protect yourself with a psychopath is to avoid him or her, to refuse any kind of contact or communication. The only truly effective method for dealing with a sociopath you have identified is to disallow him or her from your life altogether. If total avoidance is impossible, make plans to come as close as you can to the goal of total avoidance. Let's talk on that one.
Yeah,
sociopath is your boss, and the sociopath is your boss in the workplace. How do you implement this?
Let me just mention first for us that I did add a little time, but just to make sure that
we're able to do whatever we need to.
So just
okay,
know
that's
that.
Fine. Thanks, Tom. Okay, let's go back to the question. The question is, how do you deal with the psychopath in the workplace?
Well, I've been targeted in the workplace to the point of being run out of my position to the current position I'm in, and it's extremely difficult when they set their sights on you.
Mm-hmm.
What I dealt with went over a year of just being targeted, and, you know, finally I was able to resolve it, and that person no longer works there, but it took a lot to survive.
What happened, I mean, in my own personal experience, I document everything that someone says. I am a documenter. I document anything said to me on the day it was said and when it was said. That's what I do, especially when I feel that I'm in a hostile workplace, which I'm not saying my job is a hostile workplace. I'm just saying whenever I feel that I start documenting because I'm going to need that knowledge at a later time. So in dealing with this, what I have learned to do in my 21 years of working in the field that I work in is to, through the documentation, I'm allowed to produce a record of truth.
Yes. But also
so
a witness here and there doesn't hurt.
Right. But I have no problem confronting the psychopath, the crazy person, or the dictator. Mm-hmm. Because I come in truth. So it is in my truth, in my documentation, that I can then point out that is simply not correct. See, it's not my job to prove someone to be a liar. My job is to show the actions and let their inconsistency to prove them to be the liar.
Yeah.
You know?
I think you're right there. I think actions speak louder than words, they say, don't they?
Absolutely.
So if you're showing someone's actions, that's clearer than words in many ways.
Absolutely, especially the psychopath also likes to speak about you. He likes to talk about you behind your back to get other people to agree with what he or she does. So, you know, I've got a statement that I always throw out there to people and to plant that seed in. A person never speaks more clearly about them, about their own self, as when they're speaking on someone else.
So
always remember
right?
that.
That's what Kenneth's mother did to him. You know, she's the devil. And she transferred that trait to her own sons. One fun thing about a liar, that, the more rope you give them, the easier it is to take them down, because they can't remember what they said 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw my mother there abusing the girls and all when we were growing up, and some of my siblings have actually grown up now to abuse their children. So that chain has continued through my family, and some of them went on to abuse their children. Some of them love their children, but I do know there's abuse within the family, and it's a shame that they didn't catch her and stop that cycle, because the cycle has now went on to other siblings in the family.
Yeah,
I know. I just took a family trip back, and I watched all the cycle of where it's continued in the next generation and what's happened to them. And I just stand back going, like, y'all don't understand how this is all connected, but I could see it all so clearly.
Yeah.
And they're just playing out these cycles. But it's very hard when you pulled yourself out of the cycle of abuse, but you have to go back in because your family, you have to reconnect with them from time to time. I've cut myself off as much as possible just for my own survival.
Yeah.
But from time to time, I still have to go back in there and try to survive it.
And I think there's something else to add there now, in that a person can only be responsible for themselves. You know, we see that these things happen in our families. And I was with some students today, and one of the people was really in a bad way, because she saw her sister in a difficult situation and couldn't do anything to help, and was desperate to find a way of helping. And you know, there is that time as adults where adults are no longer small children. Adults make their own decisions. They take their own responsibility. So we can't always go back and put it right.
Yeah.
For
the others,
to survive, just
you know,
not being sucked in.
Yeah. And
for
so that distancing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's very hard.
Awesome.
Oh, it's so hard.
Oh God, yeah. If you love people, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, and then you love the people that you see that are so broken, and you wish that you had the power to save them, but it's kind of like a drowning person that's trying to pull you under.
You don't want
them to drown, but you don't want them to take you down either.
And you don't have the power to save them, actually.
I know.
Yeah, and that's tough when we are caring, and people with empathy and caring about other people. Sometimes we have to stand by and say, I've done all I can do no more.
Right.
Yeah, and that also plays into other aspects of your life, like when you have the alcoholic in your life that you love, that you're trying to get help for, you know. It's not, help is there, but help is only there to actually help the person when they actually want it. So it can't be forced on them, you know. You can't force the psychopath to realize that they're a psychopath.
In the world that
they painted, where the sky is pink, they're the king of that world. Okay, so you're not going to dispute the world, you know.
Just a quick one. In that children make their own decisions about life and how they are going to respond to it.
Yes.
This is something Adler understood, that before children are five, they've got a fairly good understanding of how they are going to deal with things. And so this is why in a family, some children will turn into abusers themselves and others won't, because they make their own sense of what's going on, and they make a decision, I'm going to be like that or I'm going to avoid being like that. So this is why in all those children, they'll all be different, because they'll all have made their own decisions about how life is and how they can respond to it, how they can help themselves not be in such a difficult position. You know, how do they deal with it? How do they make themselves feel more equal, feel less inferior? So each child will make their own choice.
Very good. Very good point. Thank you very much for that, Elaine. Number nine is about questioning your tendencies to pity too easily. Respect should be reserved for the kind and the morally courageous. I couldn't agree with that statement more. I hear so much, that's an elder, respect, respect, respect. And I'm not talking elder in the tribal sense. an elder as a senior citizen or someone older than you. You know what? There is a sense of respect, absolutely. And that sense of respect comes from a child who is brought up in a healthy, loving, caring relationship. That's where healthy respect comes from in a child. But this is talking about as an adult now that don't get fooled into this respect game. I do not play the respect game. Respect to me is not given. It is definitely earned. Now, I can simply come respectfully into a conversation or into a subject and respectfully say my piece. Because that is from me inside. That is my individual freedom of who I am. But to have to come into a conversation that you must respect and you can't talk against, I choose not to go there. If I can't express who I am as a person, then I don't need to be in that subject. So I think I got off a little bit on this. But this one is not to pity too easily. Because, once again, the psychopath will use their pre-planned to get you on their
again,
side.
If I can just jump in again, too. For me, there's another word which is useful, which is compassion. Because compassion is different to pity. Because compassion means that you can understand the person's suffering. You can understand the pain they're in. It's not pitying. It's not saying, oh, they're there, oh, that's all right then. But you can see. So for example, looking at Kenneth's situation with the mother having those sociopathic behaviors and you know, that was there. And then the next generation she modeled that, and some of the next generation are doing the same thing. They're doing that from a place of real pain. That's what was modeled. That's what they believed life was like.
She broke his leg.
There because, sorry?
Yeah, but when she broke his leg, she did just this. She campaigned for sympathy. She turned herself into the victim right in front of his eyes. And as a child, wanting only his mother's love and respect, he did what she had wished him to do.
Well, here's the other piece of it, too, is we can't believe a person doesn't have emotion. So we look at them and their behavior, and we project emotion onto them. And then we react and treat them as if they're really having the emotion we think they're having, when in reality they're not having any emotion at all. But that just is making us a victim, because it's pulling us into their web, and then we lose everything.
And that's where
don't care.
Yeah, and that's where pity is not useful.
Right, it's not useful.
Yeah, it's not. Pity is not useful. And whereas if we are going to engage with this and work with it and break the cycle, compassion and empathy is important, because we need to understand the painful place that some of these behaviors originated from.
Right. But
so
you have to look at the actions of a person and don't hold them to the same standard everybody else does. Sometimes it's like the most simplest thing, they act like they can't complete, while asking you to complete 50 times more than that. So it's making them accountable for their actions and refusing to lower the bar to allow them to get away with it.
It's standing firm and standing strong, isn't it?
Yeah.
Having courage.
Having courage to call them on their stuff.
So with that, we're going to number 10. Number 10 is, do not try to redeem the unredeemable. Second, third, fourth, or fifth chances are not for people who possess are for people who possess consciences. But I'm going to tell you that kind of confuses me. Because with the three rule, we've already set the pattern of who you are as a person after the third time you've done it. And we've addressed it on number two with communication and the first time you did it on communication. So if you're looking at someone that you're dealing with a subject, or you're dealing with a person that every time something new comes up and you got to deal with them on, and they let you down 2, 3, 4, 5 times, not on one instant, but on several throughout this relationship, this should be red flags. There should be like flashing signs above this person's head.
Right.
No? It would be nice if they all would wear a badge.
Yeah.
I think what happens when people are in a relationship with someone who's got sociopathic tendencies is that they are blinded, and they also believe what they are told about how terrible they are.
Right.
You are hopeless. You are useless. I'll love you if you do this, you know.
Oh, good point.
Leave me, you wouldn't survive on your own, et cetera, et cetera. So that the person, the partner in the relationship becomes totally discouraged and loses their ability to act.
So your power to fight them is only as good as your belief in yourself.
Yeah, and so you believe what they're telling you. You think, oh, they will change. Tomorrow they'll be better.
Right.
Because I love them and I believe what they're saying. So you're blind to what's really going on.
Yep.
And then in most relationships that already have this happening in them, you have a relationship of one who's dominant and one who's obedient, which goes right into number 11, which is never agree out of pity or for any other reason, which would be that obedience that I was just speaking of, to help a psychopath conceal his or her true character. You know, and that's exactly what happens.
And that's why they want to learn your secrets.
The dominant.
They want to learn your secrets because in the time
when
they're about to be busted,
they can hurt you when you try to pull away from them.
Yes, when they're about to be busted, that's when they're going to call in all the secrets that they've gathered from you, and that's why you don't give away your secrets.
Right.
To shame you, blackmail you, whatever they need to do to silence you.
Yeah. And once again, I saw that Kevin's mother did this to him also, because. She played the please don't tell, often spoken with tearful and great gashings of teeth. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, they're going to put me away forever. The best thing that could have happened to those children was that woman to go away. But a child doesn't realize that. A child, like Nell said, projected that love and that understanding, those emotions into that woman because that's what they had.
You know?
Right. Oh, yeah. We no matter what she was doing to us, we thought that one day she would just stop. We thought it would just stop someday. But it didn't seem to stop. It was from, you know, coming up and waking us up at 4 in the morning and starting our punishment from 4 in the morning. It was constant during the day. Well, you came home from school. You were beaten as soon as you got in. Never allowed out to play or anything. I mean, she totally controlled our minds when we were children. And it is very sad for a child to have to go through that. And I am a survivor. I have gotten this far from it. But I know that there can't be too many people who have actually survived going through what we've been through. I would say most people will commit suicide from having to live a childhood like that. So I can see why there's so many children do commit suicide because of a sociopathic parent. You know, if the child, I tried to kill myself when I was, I think, about 9. I tried to take poison in the house one day, just to get out of there, to get away from it. It's just a very bad environment for a young child to have to go through.
Kevin, Ken, I can see that coming with what you just said. I saw that coming. I didn't want to ask the question. But I did see that coming from what you just said, that you tried to kill yourself, when you explained that at 7, 8 years old that you would go into the room and kneel down to pray to God to take you from this world.
Oh, yeah. Well, you just didn't want to go through another day. I mean, we totally lost our childhoods. Myself and Patrick talk all the time. Patrick's over in Wales. And we were just talking just the other day, and we said, listen, you know, what she has done, she took away every moment of enjoyment that we could have had as children. We don't know we don't know nothing about sports because we were not allowed out. She confined us to the house. She had total control of our minds. And I don't know how we didn't crack up and kill ourselves while we were in the house.
And see, when she would walk you down the street and people would say, what beautiful children, and she would say they're the devil themselves, society themselves knew. You didn't live in a large city like I live in today. You lived in towns, and they would know. What is she talking about? Those boys never leave the house. Those boys never get in trouble. but society allowed that type of perception.
Right. It, society allowed it to happen. The social workers knew what was going on in that house. And I believe she had the social workers just as scared as she had us. They were petrified. I remember them coming in the door, and she'd have them scared by the time they'd leave the house.
And
she was
and
in full control of everything in her world.
Well, the other way to defend yourself is to learn how to deal with somebody who's intimidating, because that's how they silence you, too. It's like you may see them, but do you have enough guts to say you see them to their face? And most people don't.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go on to 12 and 13. I'm sorry?
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to say that's where courage comes in, too, and that people don't kill themselves is a huge tribute to courage, to that sense of, well, I'm still here. You know, I'm still here, and I'm going to keep going, because you're not going to get to me, actually. You're not going to beat me. In the end, you're not. I'm going to survive.
Right.
Well, we got 5 minutes left for, and I know that Nell's got more time on it for us to continue talking, but five more minutes left for our listeners in the chat room to hear. So I want to get in 12 and 13, and then we can pick up from there.
They can hear. They'll hear. They'll continue to hear
great.
As well.
Number 12 will be to defend your psyche. That's who you are. It's your conscience, who you are. It's everything about you. Defend it. You are the defender of you. Defend your psyche. Do not allow someone without conscience or even a string of such people to convince you that humanity is a failure. Most human beings do possess conscience. Most human beings are able to love. And number 13 is once you've established by going through these, and you know who in your life is good and who is the one that's going to harm you. Number 13 is living well is your best revenge.
Exactly.
It is your knowledge. I don't know if revenge is a good word, but it is your knowledge. It is your best thing that could happen
defense.
To you once you become knowledgeable of these types of people who can and will affect the style of life that you choose to live.
I would say living well is the best redemption.
Perfect. The best redemption. Absolutely. Perfect.
And don't be the one.
You deserve a good life.
Yeah. Don't be the one to continue to cycle abuse on yourself and become internally the abuser that you left behind. You left them behind, and be thankful and try to work on letting it go and not have the power over you now. Don't carry it with you, and don't keep yourself in a cage where you have the key to the lock.
We all travel many paths in this life, and we all head towards the same goal, and that is happiness.
Yes. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us face more difficult, and some of us keep having them put into our path, and we have to hurdle them every day of our lives. When we become conscious of who these people are in our lives and the things that they, those blocks that they put up in our lives, you start to recognize them. And you start to realize, I can get by without this in my life. Everyone strives to happiness. Clear your path.
Blood is not thicker than, everybody talks about blood all the time and staying with your family. Sometimes your best choice is to just leave it all behind and start
again. As we heard today, the ones who love you hurt you the worst.
Absolutely.
You know.
Well, I don't. That feels like a very depressing thought. But I think yes, because you're open to the pain much more if they're the ones who are supposed to love you. That's true. But I think there's something about. I'm not sure if happiness is what we're all striving for. Some of us are just striving to survive, and we do our best. You know, some of us may not ever attain happiness.
What should we survive for, though? Survive for what? If there's nothing to look forward
to,
what do we survive for?
Yeah. To having as
good
a life as we can. Yeah. To have as good a life as we can, because for some of us, there may be so much pain that we can't be totally happy. We may have moments of fleeting joy and appreciation and love, but, happiness is a big ask.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
And I don't mean to sound negative there, but I think there's something about contentment. There's something about saying, yeah, for today, this is what
I can
do.
Yeah.
This is what I can manage.
Right.
I'm still here.
Yeah.
I guess I was being projectual. Yeah. I was projecting my own happiness on everyone else. Then.
You're doing a brilliant job with it, too.
You're projecting on me, Russ.
You know, to me that is. I mean, but then, you know, you can ask the next person. You're absolutely right, Lane. The next person can be freedom is. And the next person could be, you know, just peace in my life. I don't care about happiness. Just peace, you know.
Yeah,
so you're absolutely right. It's an individual thing, absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome show. Awesome show. Some good information.
I was hoping David would do us the honor of playing a song at the end. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Would you do us the honor of playing a song?
Well, let's wrap it up here first, and then we'll let you we do appreciate it. Thank you. First of all, Elaine, Ken.
Yeah.
Thank you. Amazing.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to speak to you, and I'm so touched by your openness and honesty, all of you, and your willingness to grapple with this stuff.
And Elaine,
example.
Elaine, yeah. I had a problem understanding your accent.
Oh, I'll put on a Scottish accent then. That might be easier.
I didn't sound Irish, did I?
Yeah, I can hear it.
I can hear it too.
In background.
It's an American Irish, but I can definitely
Irish
hear Irish.
Background too.
Yeah.
So listen, I live in Wales, Kenneth. You said
Patrick is in Swansea.
Well, we're not so far away from each other. We're about 40 minutes away from each other.
Oh, okay.
So if ever you visit, you know, let's meet up.
He was down at the air show today in Swansea.
Right. I live near Lampeter, which is about 45 miles from Swansea.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you're ever down this way, then, you know, let's meet for a talk.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And a spot.
Are you guys connected on Facebook?
I don't think we are.
I'm not too sure.
Well, you won't be watching today. How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah. See, we're
and thanks
we're
for having us on
stuff.
The show again.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking good stuff and making good connections. Absolutely. Thanks for being part of the network. And, Kenneth, I'm just amazed that what we went over today is basically everything you discussed before we even talked about it today.
Great. Thank you.
So thank you both very much to both of you. Find that peace, happiness, contentment, whatever it is you're looking for. Thank you both.
Yeah.
Take care.
And thanks to all you guys. Lots of love.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
And with that, and we will have my brother David bring us out of the show. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for joining, and we'll talk to you next week. Walk in peace. We're leaving.